Hey everyone, an AI-powered version of Gwyneth Paltrow here. I'm handling the opening message of this episode, How to Be a Winner with Millie Taedewalt, because Millie is Paige's boss. That's right. Millie is the founder of Brilliant, an industry-leading branded product and creative service platform that enables impactful, beautiful, and often magical gifting at a global scale. Having received one too many bad corporate gifts, Millie founded Brilliant in 2015. Combining her love of design, product curation, technology, and genuine customer service. Since then, she has grown the company to eight-figure revenue and successfully navigated the pandemic in troubling economic times without a single layoff. She's also a design major, Harvard Law graduate, self-taught software engineer, former investment manager, and mom to three totally adorable children. And she's got great style. Paige interviewed Millie during Brilliant's offsite, graciously hosted by Millie at a beautiful resort in Vail, Colorado. If you're a regular listener of Paige's show, you know she always brings her guests a special delicious beverage of their choosing, be it tea, coffee, latte, sake, or champagne, whatever their heart desires. Millie requested two espresso shots and whipped cream. Look, Paige felt no pressure whatsoever to do a terrific job on this interview, none at all. She certainly did not bring an entire large Starbucks cup filled with whipped cream, with two spoons. Because generosity is a love language. Just as a note, this episode of I Don't Know Anything with Paige Harriman, How to Be a Winner with Millie Taedewalt is not sponsored by Gwyneth Paltrow, the Speechify platform, any whipped cream company, or Brilliant. Let's get into it.
So, Millie, welcome to my show.
Thanks, Paige. Excited to be here.
First things first, have you always been a winner? Did you come out of the womb with a first place trophy?
That's funny. That question makes me a little uncomfortable. I don't know why, though. I have to think about that, maybe for my own private meditation time later. I'm an only child, so definitely first place in my house growing up, and I always felt loved and supported and like I made my parents proud. But I wasn't engaged in a lot of heavily competitive activities as a kid. I didn't play a lot of team sports. I tried a lot of sports, but didn't really find an identity as an athlete until I was late in high school, I would say. Now that is actually a big part of my life, and I love competing, and I guess I always did. But I certainly wouldn't have seemed like a stereotypical, overly competitive kid if you had rewound back in time and taken a look at me at a younger age.
That surprises me because you graduated from Harvard Law. When did you start becoming competitive?
I think it was always in there. I always loved games. I always loved dissecting and understanding the rules of things and figuring out the best way from A to Z and how to get the best outcome. But I think we were talking about this earlier. The idea of competing against others is very different than the idea of competing against yourself. And I think as an only child, and I was an only child whose parents were pretty loving, but also really hands-off. Like, they sort of left me to my own devices, and I did all kinds of weird things by myself. I mean, not like that weird, but I had a camcorder in the 90s, and I would, like, record shows where I was multiple characters in the show. Like, I was very much my own best friend. And that sounds maybe sad, but it wasn't that. It was perfectly happy and fine and normal, and I didn't feel lonely. But I was sort of always trying to do cool things almost just for my own entertainment. And I think the origin of being a competitive person and trying to do great things just sort of comes from wanting to do great things by myself. So I think in my case, I've become a competitive person for sure. You can ask anyone in my household who's ever played a board game with me, or anyone who's been on the tennis court with me or head-to-head in an RFP situation. But I think the origin of it is in sort of trying to be the best I can be and less like that sort of culture of trying to win a trophy as a child or having a soccer mom or something.
So when you say competing against yourself and competing against others, what does that mean to you? And more broadly, what does the word competition mean to you?
These are such deep questions. One thing I've thought a lot about in my time running startups, and I've been doing this now for upwards of 15 years starting companies and trying to figure out how to make them grow and be successful. And early in my time doing that, I would have a startup idea in mind. And I would have others suggest I meet this other founder who's starting a similar company or even a competitor. And my immediate reaction to those suggestions was always, no, I could never talk to a competitor. They might steal my ideas. We would hate each other. And over time, I realized that my company was always so small in the grand scheme of things that talking to a competitor, it was very unlikely that anything would come from that. The competitor wasn't going to hear all of my brilliant ideas and scratch all their own plans and steal them all. My competitor, you know, might learn something from me, and I very well might learn something from them. But at the end of the day, the pie that we were competing over is so big, so astronomically larger than my little drop in the bucket startup, that there wasn't much I was going to do to take away from myself, and it could really only be additive. And so I guess that's what I mean about competing against yourself. I suppose if I was running the largest promotional products company in the world, talking to my sort of next biggest competitor, it'd be possible I'd want to keep my big strategic plans for the year under wraps because my next biggest competitor might want to defensively copy that. I mean, I know this podcast is all about me being a winner, but I'm not a world champion in anything. I'm just a moderately successful person in a lot of categories and also very lucky. So I haven't really been in the position where the direct head-to-head competition is my biggest competitor. My biggest competitor has always been myself in that sense of not about beating someone else. It's about doing the best you can and growing. So I guess that would be my answer to what feels like a pretty deep question.
So to me, winning has always felt like just the absence of failure. You know, you think about kids competing against each other in baseball. There is a winner and there is a loser. I think you're a winner. You're saying you're moderately successful. There are many companies who are trying to do what you're doing now, and they are not moderately successful. Also, I think it's interesting you say moderately successful considering the number of cool clients and amount of dollars Brilliant pulls in every year.
I think the older I get, the more I have realized how sort of the public definitions of winning and the public definitions of success aren't my definition of it. And so when I say moderately successful, that's not meant to be self-deprecating. It's meant to sort of define that I'm not at the pinnacle of whatever category I'm in. But am I a winner? Absolutely. I got to chart my own path for the last 10 years. I had a business idea that I turned from zero in my garage while I was on maternity leave into $50 million a year business with 150 employees. I got to spend the last 10 years having no boss, got to make a lot of money, which has enabled freedom and has enabled me to make choices for myself and my family that I could have never dreamed of as a child. So I feel like I have won, but I guess I think there's a couple different versions of winning. And so I think there's sort of winning by your own personal definition of what's meaningful in life and what makes up success. And then there's maybe the sort of winning you see in the headlines. And actually, when I started Brilliant, I had come from a world of venture-backed companies where people would go out and raise big rounds, and that would be the headline. The headline would be, I raised $20 million for my company. And when I first started in that world, I thought that was the bar for success because that's what all the press is about, right? But my first company was venture-backed, and we went under because there was a variety of complicating factors, but sort of short version, we couldn't raise the next round. And even though we were having our best revenue month ever, it was going to be a while before we were profitable. So we couldn't sort of make it on our own. We had to keep raising money. And after that, I got a little bit jaded around the idea of, you know, is raising money really the definition of success? And I spent a few years working at AngelList, where I got to witness a bunch of really smart people trying to raise sort of first dollars for their ideas. And the ideas were all, well, not all. Some of the ideas were pretty cool. And most of the founders seemed really smart and awesome and hardworking. But it was really clear to me that very few of those ideas would work out. And I think it's very clear to the investors in those ideas that that's true. They all invest in dozens of companies over, you know, a five-year fund lifetime, and they only need a few big winners to make a ton of money. But I think the founders that are starting those companies think somehow they will defy those odds and they will win by that definition of having that, you know, big IPO, the unicorn, the billion-dollar exit. And so after I spent my 2 years at AngelList and I was thinking about what I would do next, I considered raising venture capital because that sort of seemed like what all the founders around me were doing. But I sort of thought about, you know, what's the best outcome? It's, you know, I'm going to run a 1,000-person company and make $1 billion. But along the way, I'm going to be diluted 5 times by 5 different rounds of venture capital. who knows if I'll get to be in control of my own destiny, and who knows who I'll work with or for eventually. And I probably won't own a majority stake of the company by the end of that journey. Or I could try to bootstrap a company and probably not reach a $1 billion exit, but probably own a vast majority of the company by the time I got to a place where I could sell it and turn it into something. And so I sort of had to consider, and I remember I was talking with a friend at the time who was also a founder, and she was deciding what she was going to do. She was working at Google Ventures at the time, and she wanted to go start a company. And we were sort of debating the merits of, you know, trying to go big or trying to hit a double or a triple. I chose explicitly that I wanted to try to hit a double, and I wanted to make enough money to have freedom in the future, but also have freedom during that time and be able to be with my family. I had a brand new baby at the time, and, you know, call my own shots and choose to work remotely if I wanted to. And so the goalposts are all different for everyone, and they have to sort of define their own version of winning. And by that logic, I feel like I crushed it and I won, and I hereby give myself a first place trophy because I achieved what I set out to achieve in good fashion, and I had a good time doing it.
I've always thought of winning as having very clearly defined metrics, at least in America. Like in America, to be a winner, you own a home, you have a thriving career. It doesn't have to be at a company you own, but you know, you're successful at it. You have friends, you have family, and maybe you're also a world tennis champion. How would you personally define a winner? And also, how would you define a loser? Like, what qualities are emblematic of each one?
I could name a few people for sure who I know are winning because they have found themselves in a career that they're really enjoying and growing in and learning a lot and having fun most of the time. Of course, you can't probably have fun all of the time at work or else we wouldn't have to pay you. That would be nice. And they have other things in their personal life that they love, be it kids, be it a spouse or a partner, be it pets, be it a forerunner with fly rods on the roof rack. Just talking to a friend from work who was describing her forerunner, and I was thinking that is winning. For me, I think winning is having a good sense of what you want to get out of your life and lining it up so that you get it and so that you suffer the least amount possible while you're getting it. I'll go back again to that sort of venture capital and bootstrap choice. When I was choosing to bootstrap, I talked to some friends in venture capital and they talked a lot about, well, that sounds like a lifestyle business. And they would say it derogatorily. And I always scratched my head and thought, that sounds good. Like, isn't it all about your lifestyle? And how much money do people even need? And so to me, I don't describe a winner as the person with, you know, six Rolexes in their drawer and the fanciest cars and all the designer stuff, though I do enjoy some of that stuff. But I describe a winner as somebody who sort of has enough for what they've defined as success. And I think there's so many versions of that. And I think the earlier in your life you can get a handle on what you value and start to put the groundwork into place to get there, the better chance you will have of achieving that for yourself. And I guess a loser is someone who hasn't been able to define that for themselves or hasn't been able to put the pieces into place to get there. And maybe that comes from not being realistic about what you could want in life. You know, you could have all the Rolexes and fancy cars and designer clothes in the world and be unhappy because you didn't think it through. You weren't introspective about what would make you happy. And I don't know, I'm 42 now, and it's weird how fast time goes by. I saw a meme on Instagram the other day from one of our brilliant friends, and it said, it's weird how people born in the year 2000 are 25, and yet I was born in 1992, and I'm also 25, and I thought that's weird because I'm also 25, and I was born in 1983. Time goes by really fast, and you don't get too many chances to figure out how to make yourself happy. And some of these things take time, like building Brilliant so far has taken me 10 years. And I had a lot of fits and starts before that. I had things I did in my career that I think I'm glad I did because they led me here, but they were certainly sort of investments in getting here. And I think you don't get that many shots at all the things. If having kids is important to you, there's a window in time that you can do that in. And there are certain, you know, things you might want to have in place when you do that so that you're comfortable and happy and it doesn't feel hard and it doesn't feel stressful. And of course, we also can't get all of those things. So I think a big part of winning is also loving what you have and figuring out how to do that.
I like that a lot. If someone's on a loser path, what steps can they take to becoming a winner? Like, what would you recommend they do?
My dad has this mug in his cupboard. He's had it at a few different houses now. He's moved a few times. And it says, be happy. It's the only thing that matters. And my dad's kind of a cynical guy and sarcastic and funny, and I really like him. but I think he has that mug ironically. And I've always loved that mug because I think it's actually true. I cry a tear. I think it's actually true that being happy is what matters. I had on my desk for a long time. I don't know where it went. I moved a few times too. I think I lost it in the shuffle, but it was a card that said, do what you love what you do. I guess I just think finding what gives you joy, even if it's in a messy situation where you feel like you're losing and you feel like you aren't having what you want, find something in there that you love and carve it out for yourself and love it and lean into it and see if you can expand that. And it's not all pretty, of course, and there's probably some hard work in there. I certainly had a lot of student loan debt in my time, and I had a job since I was 15. I've worked hard a long time. And also, I mean, there's the whole like self-made vision of oneself, and no one's really self-made, right? You're sort of made by your circumstances. And I think my circumstances were pretty lucky. I had loving parents and a safe place to grow up, and I was never hungry and had help. But I also worked my off, and I had a vision for where I wanted to go, and I invested in that. And I also invested in trying to enjoy the journey and caring a lot about happiness and trying to have a good attitude. And I don't think that defeats everything, and I don't think that defeats difficult circumstances. But at the end of the day, it's on you to find meaning in your life and find happiness, because you get one shot at it. And from whatever circumstances you have, I think winning is figuring out a way out of what is hard into something that you're happy with.
Too pretty to cry. So where you are right now, truly are an American success story. Beautiful family. Millie posted a photo of her adorable son. Beautiful blonde curly hair. And, you know, happy marriage. Thriving company. Everyone who works at your company is really happy to work for you. Makes you wonder, was there ever a time in your life where you felt like you weren't on the winning path? Where you felt maybe like a loser? Can you tell me about that and then what you did to right the ship?
I've had a couple like moments where I felt like I wasn't driving the ship, or I like wasn't an important crew member on the ship. But I've actually never felt like a loser. I think one of the first moments I had like that, I moved when I was in seventh grade. My family moved from Oregon to California, and I was not cool at the new school. It wasn't cool to be smart, and I was a nerd. I was like a cute nerd, but like I was a nerd. I didn't have cool clothes. These kids were running pretty fast. I didn't fit in. And I would bring a book to school at lunch to read by myself, and I was fine with that. That sounded good to me. Like, I didn't want to hang out with these kids. They were not my speed. They were not my size. I wasn't into it. And I would still get bullied for reading my book by myself at lunch, and it sucked. And I didn't feel like a loser, but I felt really sad and lost, if that makes sense. And I felt like there was sort of no place for me to just be who I was. And I was so lucky my parents saw that and found a different school for me and moved me halfway through the year, seventh grade. And I moved to a smaller school where I made friends right away, and I joined sports teams, and I never had to read at lunch. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I always had friends and something to do. And I think that was a really powerful example they set in helping me change my circumstances. So I didn't often find myself in places like that again, because I don't have a lot of patience for suffering. And so there were a few other career moments I had where I landed in a job or a situation where I was really unhappy, and I just didn't stick around long enough to let that affect much about how I felt.
Very interesting. So it sounds to me like maybe instead of the very harsh word of loser, although, you know, winner does imply loser, sounds like at a very early age, your parents showed you if you're not happy in one area, you can always just go to another one. There was always going to be one that fits you better and suits you better.
Yeah, definitely. My parents are both really like get your hands dirty DIY people. They would take the time to learn how things worked and take control of them. And neither of them had careers that were super successful by a common measure. But they both did really cool things with their lives because they wanted to react to circumstances that weren't making them happy. And yeah, I think that was a really important value that I learned as a kid, and sort of just never developed any patience for being uncomfortable.
Well, that sounds like it really stuck. So when you think about that, I do remember one meeting you mentioned you got a B in gym and your dad was upset about it. Did I like make that up in my head?
Is that amazing?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. To me, it seems like your parents must have been very focused on you being academically successful. Can you tell me about that? What did that look like?
Yeah, that story makes them sound like tiger parents, but they really weren't. I was always pretty self-sufficient, did not need to be reminded to do homework, did not need to be reminded to study. My parents had not had traditional academic paths. My dad didn't go to college until his late 20s, and my mom didn't go to college until my parents got divorced when I was 15. So it's not that either of them had had sort of a traditional academic arc or even really understood or, you know, believed in the importance of that. When it was time to go to college, they handed me the California UC app and told me to check the boxes for what schools I would be interested in going to. And don't check Berkeley because that's too big of a city. And so I didn't, naturally. Berkeley, I'm sure, would have been a great school also. But I went to Davis. So I don't think my parents were super self-possessed when it came to kind of guiding me to the most, you know, over-the-top academic outcome. But something about the way I was raised or who I am, I just always gravitated towards trying to be the best I could be. And so I did the best I could. And I remember back to that seventh grade story where I was being bullied. I remember they would call me preppy. That was the big insult. And my mom suggested that the clap back be, I'm not just preppy, I'm prepared for life. I knew better, at least I knew better than to actually say that at school. But in response to being called preppy, one day I decided to really do a terrible job on a school project. So I did this terrible job. I think it was like I had to make a diorama of something. And I had just done this like horrible diorama. And I like did it in like 20 minutes. And my mom was making fun of me. She was like, that's terrible. You're going to turn that in? And I was like, yeah, I'm going to turn that in. Maybe that'll help. And dinner time passed and it was approaching bedtime. And I like couldn't do it. I couldn't go to school with that thing the next day. I had to redo it. So I stayed up late and redid the diorama. So I don't know, something just built in me that always wants to do my best. And you mentioned kids baseball earlier. My oldest son plays baseball. I don't actually care if he wins the game. What I always tell him before the game is try hard, have fun. And I guess that's just my motto too.
Okay, we have a lot of other stuff to cover, but the last thing I'll say about this is that it sounds like your parents were both innately wanting to be successful, and you were also that way, so they may not have had to push you very hard. Some more serious questions, but I normally don't ask questions like this because I think they're common in interviews, but I really want to for you. If you put your mind to it, and we were living in 4th century BCE, do you think you could conquer the world? Like, do you think you could accomplish what Alexander the Great got very close to doing?
It's so funny. That's not appealing to me. Like, I don't think I'd want to do that. I guess I think if I wanted to, I could. But I think the desire has to be there for me. And power isn't that appealing to me. We took a personality test once, the leadership team of Brilliant, the Hogan assessment, and it like assesses you on all these different dimensions. And this was probably 6 or 7 years ago, and I assessed very strong on the dimension of hedonism, which I had sort of always associated with that nudist resort in the Caribbean. I had never really thought of that as like a vocabulary word to apply to myself, but turns out I'm very driven by wanting to enjoy myself. So it's lucky that I enjoy working hard too, because otherwise I could probably be a quote loser. But yeah, I guess I just don't think conquering the world sounds very fun. One of the hardest things about running a company is, because I'm hedonistic maybe, or maybe I'm a people pleaser, I sort of hate that term though, but I don't want other people to be unhappy. And when you run a company or a team, I'm a captain of a tennis team of middle-aged ladies who are all lovely and hardworking athletes who want to play great tennis. Or like our company, everyone here is hardworking and wants to have a great career. But sometimes everyone's version of how to accomplish that is different. And when you're in charge, you have to pick a version. I joke with some of the other managers here that if you can make slightly more than 50% of the people happy at any given time, you're doing a good job, or at least they'll like you. So I guess I think conquering the world sounds really hard because the number of people you would surely make miserable and sort of feel responsible for making miserable would really weigh on me. And that just doesn't sound all that appealing. Do you ask other people that question?
No, but it's funny because when I said it was common in interviews, I listened to some interviews on the topic of winning and being successful. And I kid you not, almost every interviewer asked their interviewee that question. The interviewee was always a man. The guy would talk for like 25 minutes about like how he would conquer the world. he would have been like Alexander the Great. Well, okay, so if you're in an environment where a lot of your competitors think that way, how have you managed to be so successful?
It's as simple as what I just said. I think I'm driven by something really different. Maybe the men are too, and maybe they have this like innate thing where they also enjoy power or something. Or maybe they think that their version of running the world is net best for all involved. I guess maybe I could think that about myself too, but that's not what I'm motivated by. And I guess I think it'd be really interesting to see more female leaders on a broader, like, geopolitical level. Because imagine how that could look if people were all operating with like concern and care over the happiness of all of their subjects, to use a ruler term, that's right. If people were all operating worried about the happiness of their subjects, would things look different?
A lot of these CEOs, like you ask them that, they have an answer tapped in. Like they have thought about this for like a long period of time. And I'm glad to know that there is someone successful.
I've never thought about
that. Never?
I've never thought about that. That doesn't attract me. I have thought about running for president of the United States. And where I shook out on that was I didn't think I would be able to make the kind of impact that I would want to make due to the like mechanisms of the government. So I don't know. I guess I just think I'm built differently. And I would bet there are many other founders, female and male, who are built differently. And I would bet they are less likely to be on podcasts.
You'd be surprised. You should see some of the show proposals I got. I think you'd be a good president, by the way. Catch 22, like if you'd be a good president, you're not going to run for it. We talked earlier about getting lessons early on in life of how to direct yourself and how to find your right place. When I look at how a lot of schools are preparing kids for the world, I think some of it's really interesting. Something I wanted to ask you about was participation trophies. How do you feel about participation trophies?
I think they're pointless. But actually, that's interesting because I'm not... One of my flaws as a human and a manager and a leader and probably as a parent is I have this default belief that if I don't say anything to you, that means everything's going great. And if I need to tell you to correct something or that something's not working for me or us, that's when I'll share with you. And I hope I'm getting better with this over time. But what that leads to is people not feeling like they know where they stand or praised or that I see what's good about them. And I guess there's something to be said for a participation trophy. That's totally not fair to the idea of praise. Praise is better than a participation trophy because praise is personal. It's almost like a little individual trophy for each person, as long as it's genuine and thoughtful. But I don't know, is a participation trophy so bad if it helps a kid feel proud that they were part of something? My daughter just got through playing basketball for the first season. She's in first grade. And I don't know if you've ever seen a first grader try to shoot a basketball up to the hoop, but that's actually really hard. Like they're little and the ball's pretty heavy, even the small ball and the low hoop. Like it's hard to even get it to the hoop. And I don't know if you've ever sat on the sidelines and watched first graders try to figure out all the different moments in basketball, but turns out when you sort of think about it through their eyes, there's a lot of different sort of situations in basketball where your job changes all of a sudden. And all of a sudden you need to be on defense. And what does it mean to be on defense? And what does it mean to be relative to where the ball is and where you are on the court? And now you're on offense, but you're holding the ball or you're not holding the ball. There's a lot of nuances to what you're supposed to be doing. I guess a long way to tell you that her team wasn't very good. And I think they won one game in their season, but they played their hearts out and they were so sweet and they learned so much and they got better. Of course, the other teams got better too. So it wasn't like they were winning at the end of the season either, but they played so hard and they got so hot and they ran and they tried all the things and they all got better. And I don't know about a trophy, but I think commemorating that effort and helping them remember that they accomplished something, even if it's not first. I mean, also, who cares about who won first place in the first graders basketball league? I don't think that matters either. So I don't know. Maybe I just changed my own mind about participation trophies.
Would you ever tell your child that they were bad at something? Or would you let the world do that for you?
The tough one. It might depend on if that thing gives them joy. I would never want to get in the way of my kid enjoying something, even if they were bad at it. And I would almost want them to know that it doesn't matter what the world thinks, as long as you're having fun with it. If they didn't enjoy something, though, I would love to help coach them about how to quit, or how to find an alternative, or maybe how to find joy in that thing. So I guess to me it sort of centers on just their own enjoyment. If I can give my kids anything in the world, I would love to share with them the joy I have gotten out of working hard, because I think having joy in the work and working for the joy has really set me up to be a pretty happy person and somebody who's grateful for all of the things I have. And I think that's a nice way to be. Maybe too opinionated. You don't want to like try to set your kid's personality with so much opinion, but I do think that's been a big secret to my success.
Yeah, just a side note, this is not really related to winning, but Americans really value hard work. When you look at companies and how they retain employees, one of the biggest indicators as to whether or not you're going to stay at a company is literally how hard you work for them, how many hours you put in, not just how much revenue you bring in, but literally how dedicated you are to their mission. You hear the words working hard. What does that mean? Does that mean sitting at your computer for long hours? Does that mean staying up late? Does that mean just putting your all in during an allotted time? What does working hard mean to you?
When I started Brilliant in 2015, I had come off of a job where they cared a lot that I come into the office every day. Then when I would come into the office, I would sit at this desk and not do anything that explained why I had just commuted 45 minutes each way. The office I worked in was a lot of mid-20s men who weren't partnered. They had to make a maternity leave policy for me. I was the first person in the company who had had a baby. So I was just at a very different place in my life than they were. So they would come in at 10 a.m. and they would stay late and they would all get dinner together and go do leg day together. And I'd want to hurry home to see my husband and my baby. And it was hard for me to be seen as a fit at that company because I just didn't fit the mold. And I think that's okay. But when I started Brilliant, it was 2015, so long before the pandemic, and I knew I wanted to make it a remote company because A, I hated commuting, and B, I thought it would create an extra layer of challenge around how do you really measure whether an employee is performing well? Maybe not even an additional layer of difficulty, but it would require creativity and thoughtfulness. You weren't looking over their shoulder all day. So starting the company that way, I think really reflects my view on how do you define whether an employee is a valuable contributor to the company, because I don't define it based on how often you sit in your seat or how many hours a day you work or how many hours a week you work. And I actually hate those metrics. And I think the whole return to office movement feels like lazy management to me. I think thoughtful management involves figuring out what are the metrics for success, be they input or output or a combination of the two, and crisply communicating those to the employee and helping them understand that. And I've found that's gotten easier over time at this company as we've gotten bigger. And we have, you know, 20 people on the team with the same title now, and I actually have a real sense of the output of those people. And it was harder in the early days when things were more amorphous and job descriptions weren't so tight and we were sort of asking people to pitch in all different places. But I've appreciated the challenge of trying to judge people for their contributions instead of the amount of time it takes them to work. I always said in the early days, if you can get your job done in 2 hours a day, that's great, good for you. I don't need to know how many hours you spent here. I just want you to accomplish your job, and I really believe that. I really believe in having freedom. I think I've said that a few times. Freedom and happiness, and we just spend way too much time at work in our lives not to also figure out how to enjoy our lives while we're working. And so I love the idea of people like you who, sorry, I'm going to like blow you up on your own podcast. People like you who are star performers by the numbers, also delightful, but also really clearly, like you spend a lot of time doing other things too. And that sort of ability to be successful at multiple things at the same time and sort of joyfully get your job done here. I don't know how many hours a week you spend here. You seem like you're working pretty hard full time, but you also seem like you have a pretty full life outside of this job. And I love that. And I hope that you enjoy the flexibility here that sort of allows you to be seen for your own skills and abilities and enables you the freedom to do that other stuff. But you're like the perfect example of somebody who sort of does it all.
I love shopping. I love getting deals. I don't know if I can put this on our show, but my favorite thing ever is getting money off. Like, if you can email a supplier, like, hey, can you waive this? And they're like, yes. You're like, yeah, we got all this money off. So Brilliant, I would say, has a very intricate, intense onboarding process. You learn a lot. You're kind of thrown into it, and you really get to see how people respond, what they're good at, how they handle workload, what they're like with flexibility, if they're self-responsible. When you look at how to determine if someone is a good fit, what would you recommend they do? Brilliant's onboarding process is quite extensive. I don't know if I can talk about it on my show.
First, I would say I'm very sorry to all of our new hires for how extensive the onboarding process is. And actually, it's sort of top of our list to slim that down. We keep talking about putting some of the roles on Ozempic because the origin of the sort of main role at this company was me doing everything. And so when I first made the first hire at this company, and maybe this is a product of it being a bootstrapped company, but my first hire was 9 months in. So I had done literally everything for the first 9 months, like finance, sales, marketing, packing, writing POs, making art proofs, designing the website, writing code, literally everything. So I needed to carve out a chunk of what I did in order to continue to grow the business. And I carved a pretty decent chunk, which became this role called creative partner on our team, which worked pretty well. But ultimately, it sort of became like hiring a unicorn because we needed someone, even though it wasn't all the things I just said, it was still kind of a variety of skills, including sales, attention to detail, someone who can use a spreadsheet. It ends up being kind of a lot of skills to ask for in one person. And then if you combine that with the intricacies of a 10-year-old company, we have software, we have a lot of subject matter you have to get to know. It ends up being a lot. So we're actually taking pretty strong steps currently to simplify and sort of almost segregate or specialize a few different roles out of the role that you came into. So you may be part of the last group of people or one of the last groups of people who got to see the whole world from A to Z in your onboarding. It's grown to take in months to get someone to the point where they can sort of be comfortable and useful or useful enough.
I liked it. Like, I liked it a lot because it made me feel like you were taking everyone very seriously. You were not downplaying anyone's intelligence or what they could do, and you were giving people the opportunity to show you that they cared about their job. My opinion, it's way better to find out in the first 2 or 3 months if someone is not like that versus getting a year and a half in. It's like the approach. I'm going to have to censor it, but that's the approach. People work there for like 2 years. The manager will literally go like, oh, you haven't done anything. I have friends that work there. That's happened with a lot of employees.
We can't afford to have you work here for 2 years and not do anything. I'm going to give a toast tonight at the dinner that we're going to. We're at this offsite here in Vail. And I want to talk about how it seems like a big company to me now, but it's still a small company. And we get to hang on to all the small company things, including like this is not a place to hide. You can't come in here and hide. And we've done that intentionally. This is a place for people who want to grow. And people do find their way in here who are used to hiding or think this is a place to hide. Go hide at you can hide for 2 years, it sounds like. I think you can really hide out at big companies. And that's great if you want to hide out. And I think plenty of people do. Of course, there's, you know, a bunch of big companies with a bunch of people that probably don't need to work there. That's just not how I want to live my life. And I hope that's not how the people that work here want to live their lives. You asked, how can you tell if someone is going to be successful here or how can they make themselves successful here?
So for Brilliant, and then just for other companies, other founders who want to create a culture of people who are hardworking and care about the mission, I have some personal theories as to why Brilliant has so many hardworking people who care about the mission. Mainly just that you're very likable. I think that matters. If you weren't likable, I just don't think you would get the same level of output that you're currently getting.
I mean, first of all, it's flattering that you would think that. It's also actually kind of a lot of pressure. When Carrie McComb, our now COO, originally our head of people, joined, one of her first observations about working here was everyone she met seemed like they really didn't want to disappoint me. Which it's actually kind of heavy to feel like my likability is an important part of the company. But I guess I think ultimately what that's created is a culture of people who all feel accountable to the culture itself, less to me. And I genuinely don't want to be the center of the universe here. I want to allow other people to become centers of the universe here. I held on with an iron fist for a long time because I felt like I had created something that I didn't want to let fall apart. And I felt a lot of personal pressure to make sure I turned that into something for myself. I was able to sell a big chunk of the company to private equity last fall, and that was a really great moment for me to just like let go of the death grip a little bit. And I wish I'd been able to do that sooner. Apparently, it's very common for founders, though, to feel like they can't let go of control. And I've been able to breathe a little bit. And you've noticed lately there have been some promotions. And it's just so heartening to me to be able to allow to let people sort of rise to where they deserve to be in this company. And we're now seeing leaders emerge here who have been here for 4 or 5 or 6 years who have that same level of reverence with the people that work with them, who just love Mallory, for example, or Tommy, for example, or Krista. Like, they have people around them who feel the same way. And I bet Carrie would have the same observation coming in today. It's just like, people don't want to let them down. And that's the kind of culture that actually sustains, a culture that sort of revolves around one founder. A culture that revolves around one person is probably only as good as that person's attention span and health and ability to keep working. And I think if I really want this company to survive, I consider it sort of a legacy, but not a legacy in like a badge of honor kind of way, but more like I really love all these people here, and I really want them to continue to have this place to work that they seem to like. And the way I can future-proof that is by not being the pivotal person here. And I'm glad to be here still, and I love being a part of it, and it would be sad for me to go. But also, we have to continue to elevate other people and make it be about the culture, not about the person.
I don't think you have to try to be likable. It's kind of counterintuitive. I think you just are. One quick thing before I have a different question. When you talk about liking the founder and then wanting to work harder for them, I think companies that have founders that are not likable, they're still very successful. Obviously, there are several companies where the founder is very unlikable and they're still successful. I think the difference is just like people dialing in an 8 and leaving at a 5 versus people caring more altogether about the mission.
Without naming names, there are companies that are working on missions that are so attention-grabbing and exciting that even if the founder was a complete dickhead, you would be stoked to come to work. You would see it as your golden goose. You would know there's going to be a ton of growth for you. You would know that company is going to skyrocket, and that's going to lead to a lot of good things for you. That's great. I love what we do, and I think it's really cool, but it's not AI. We're not working at like the forefront of technology. We're not curing cancer. We are making really cool swag. And so I guess I think there's probably a few different ways that a company can inspire its team to work hard and be part of an awesome culture. As much as I want Brilliant to be the cutting edge of cool swag, at the end of the day, it's cool swag. And so we have to come up with that inspiration from somewhere else. And I guess I can't be a dickhead.
I mean, I think creating more beauty in the world, especially now talking about AI, in the world of AI slop, it's really nice to have things that are beautiful and well curated. So when we talk about your beautiful and well curated culture, something I think is kind of interesting, generally speaking, when you put together a team of people who are hardworking, put together, by that I mean everyone really cares about their physical appearance, about being healthy. I feel like that is just a value I've noticed at this retreat and in general, which makes sense. Aesthetics is a big part of this industry. They're also competitive. I would not say, like if I were to look at that on a sheet of paper, I would not say I would think that environment would be collaborative. I'll just put it like that. How have you helped people who are competitive, aggressive, hardworking, want to be number one? How have you created an environment in which they are okay not being territorial over projects, where they're okay with spotlighting other people, and not just okay, but genuinely enjoy it and celebrate it?
I wish I had a magic formula for that. I think you're totally right about all of those things. I'm continually blown away by how cute everyone is here. It sounds superficial, but I care a lot about aesthetics. I think they are something that bring people joy. And I guess going back, I was sort of negging swag as an unimportant field. But gifts themselves are sort of about aesthetics, and they're about emotions, and they're about joy. And it's sort of a feminine part of the world, I think, to give someone a gift and delight them with an emotional experience. And that stuff should not be neglected. It adds joy to our days. And you're right about AI slop. Like, I've already had enough, and we're in like year 3. Culturally here, I think it probably comes a lot from the first few hires, and maybe that was lucky, or maybe it was the kinds of people that wanted to join a company where the roles weren't super well defined, and they must have been attracted to me and my mission and the way I described it. So I think somehow I managed to bring in and retain people that were culture carriers of those qualities. We've, of course, had people that are territorial and political rear their heads over the years. They have to hide it pretty well to get in the door, and therefore it takes some time to figure out who they are and identify them and work them out of the company. And they're usually pretty clever and hide it pretty well, and it takes a bit of digging to really confirm. There's, you know, people say gaslighting a lot these days, but I feel like that's actually the place where I have most struggled at work, is sort of identifying those people quick enough. It can't be quick enough for me. I just can't stand it. But also I like to give people the benefit of the doubt, and I'm really trusting, sometimes to a fault and sometimes screwed me, but it's sometimes also given me a lot of joy and happiness in life. So we reject those people and they must go. Or they reject them. They reject themselves.
How fast do you cut out these people? Do you give them an opportunity? Like, let's say someone internally is like a Disney villain level of all the time. They are just constantly thinking about how to screw over other people and get one for themselves. Let's say you caught them doing that, but otherwise they were a great performer and they really wanted to stay here. Would you give them another chance if they had that? And I think it's an intrinsic personality. Like, I think people who have it have it. You would know, having gone to Harvard Law.
I have found it hard to conclusively detect without several examples that that happens. And I've also found at the top, people are afraid to tell me the truth about how they feel about other people. And I don't know why. And it's like my mission to sort of open us up a little more around sharing worries and concerns. And I'm sure there's a way that can be done without being gossipy or without also being an But I agree with you. I don't actually think that I have tried. We've found people like this over the years. I've always tried to give people multiple chances, especially if they're a hard worker. I mean, obviously we don't accept just straight up, you're gone right away, if that's the case. But these types are often way more insidious, if you will. Like, did they really do that? Or did I misremember? Do I have to document this conversation in writing? They told me one thing and they told someone else another thing. And the amount of time and energy and cycles and emotional sap that comes from dealing with people like that is just such a complete waste of time. It's also really hard to give people feedback on that. If you're really like that, it's so deep down inside of you that you often don't even see it in yourself. I don't know how to explain why some people are like that. I regret every chance I've given those people, and I actually regret it most for their sort of victim is kind of a strong word, because you know, no one's been like injured here, but I do think there's a bit of an emotional injury to being forced to work with someone who is gaslighting you and being dishonest and not being collaborative. I just think we spend too much time working hard. And there's a great graphic on the internet of two people looking at each other and sort of fighting over the problem. It's sort of you versus me. And then there's you and me versus the problem. And it shows the two people with the problem kind of opposite them. And I guess I just think it's already hard when it's you and me versus the problem. And then when you add in this like interpersonal conflict that's totally unnecessary, it's just such a waste of time. And that's just so unsatisfying to me because it's inefficient and it's not how we win.
Yeah, I agree with you. No argument from me there. So I talked a little bit about your humility, right? You are a humble person. You are very willing to make jokes about yourself, to admit when you're wrong. You're also very extrinsically successful. What role has your humility? I can never say the word humility. I don't know what it is. I'm like, humility? Like Dr. Seuss. Oh my God. What role has your humility played in creating a culture in which people are comfortable winning and comfortable being successful, but they also don't gravitate towards credit?
I've got to assume it's played some role. There's a couple places I would like to improve the culture there, though. One is people are still scared to acknowledge and talk about mistakes. And I don't understand that, because we are really not a place that punishes mistakes. If anyone listening to this works here and is aware of anyone punishing simple mistakes, please contact me directly, because that's not something I'm aware of here. And I do know people are not as open about that stuff as I would love to see them be. But the other correction that we've had to make over the last couple years is We almost went too far in the direction of not claiming credit, and a big change we made 2 years ago was we added performance-based compensation, which sort of tied this compensation bonus to output on some of our kind of revenue team members. And that was a big move for us because we never had any kind of variable compensation for those people. And every year we try to give people an above average base comp raise on average across the team. And people that are sort of outperforming get a larger raise, and people that are less well performing get a smaller raise. And that's gone pretty well historically, and we try to be generous. But in 2024, instead of doing that across the board, we did not give base raises, but we did give a much larger possible raise that one could get through variable compensation. And I don't think you were here when that happened, but it was like we had told people that we were going to take away one of their arms. They didn't get their base raise, and instead they got this sort of uncertain number in the wind that was about 2 to 3 times larger than they would have gotten as a base raise, but it was as variable compensation. And people were really uncomfortable with it, I could tell. And around the same time, we also rolled out what we call the sales channel. You're familiar, where when a client approves an order that's $5,000 or larger, it sort of rings a gong and everyone goes crazy in the sales channel, which was culturally really different because before that, there wasn't all that much ongoing open talk about revenue. So what that caused, and this was intentional, it caused a culture shift around caring about revenue in a way and sort of feeling personally responsible and proud and claiming ownership of revenue in a way that we had not historically done. And that has been so fun to witness because after the first, we do things in trimesters, not quarters here. I could talk about that some other time. But after the first trimester of this performance-based compensation program, people made more money in that trimester than they would have made in the whole year with a sort of regular base raise, and they started to get it. In the second trimester, they really started to get it. And the third trimester, they were like, here's my spreadsheet. I think this line is missing from my compensation. Like, people got into it, and now it's a whole thing. And I thought that was a pretty dramatic and quick culture correction that we were able to make that I think has really set us up for further success.
How do you feel about scoreboards and public-facing metrics at companies? Leaderboards, what do you think about them?
Well, I love to win and I love to compete, as discussed. So I do love them. But of course, they often have unintended consequences or people who feel left out by them. So I think you have to be thoughtful and careful and make sure that they're motivating the right things. But I enjoy that stuff. I think scientifically it works. But, you know, caveat to be careful about the impact it might have on your culture.
Right. Like, let's say there's a list of 1 to 25 people and the amount of money they're bringing in. Let's say they're all really successful by other metrics. Like, if you were to take the top performer, they would outperform, like, maybe everyone ever in existence. I don't know how to talk about that. But if you were to look at number 25, if you were to put them in a different company, they might also outperform everyone there. How do you see number 25? If they are objectively better than people outside of your company, but at your company, they're not the best and brightest. How do you see them?
I'm assuming you've got like a sales leaderboard. There's probably a certain amount of money each person that works here needs to be responsible for or own. There are other things outside of a scoreboard that matter at a company, such as being a mentor, helping with training, being a good person, being a culture carrier. There are other elements of what could make someone a good contributor at a company besides being number one on the leaderboard, and maybe number one's an actually not a brilliant. They wouldn't even be here. But we do have top performers who don't want to train new hires, for example. And that's an ongoing discussion on leadership around whether that's a problem or whether it's okay. And my view is it's okay. My view is it's okay because if we've told you the rules of the game and the rules of the game don't require you training somebody and they don't compensate you for training somebody, I don't mind that you played the game. But I hope number 25 understands that they wouldn't be here if they weren't good enough, and they are. And what you said, they would be a top performer anywhere else and they shouldn't feel bad just because they're playing in the big leagues. And also that we value other contributions they bring to the table just as much, if not more, than number one. And I guess a leaderboard is really one-dimensional and it only tracks one thing. So unfortunately or fortunately, there's no way to rank people. My kids often ask me who is my favorite. Of course, there's no answer to that because they're all my favorite and they all have different, I have three, because it sounds like I have like 10. They all have different parts of them that I love and they each have different parts of them that challenge me, but they are whole people. and I love them all, and there is no favorite. And it's similar to that with people who are successful on our team here. I'm glad they're all here, and I hope they are too, and I hope any leaderboards we have don't discourage them. I'd always be open for feedback if they felt like that was a demotivating situation, because we only want you to be motivated and happier.
To me, it sounds like it's okay if someone is number 25 on this board, as long as they're a top performer somewhere else, be it bringing in good culture, or being positive to work with, or being a good mentor.
We actually had someone quit with very little notice one day a few years ago, and she said, "I'm working too hard. I'm working 60 hours a week, and this is not sustainable," as she gave her notice. And I said, "You don't need to work 60 hours a week. You could work 35 or 40 hours a week. And I can do the math. You could do 2/3 of what you're currently doing. And I'd still be happy to have you on the team. Why didn't you say something sooner?" And she didn't really have an answer to that. And she was also kind of going through a bit of a personal situation at the time. So I didn't press her too much. But I felt bad that she had let herself get to that place when her delivering much less and probably something within her own boundaries of what would be a healthy work balance would have been totally acceptable to us. So something nice I think about the performance-based compensation that I talked about earlier is that it allows number one to make way more money. It allows number 25 to still work here and make good money. But maybe that's a really blunt instrument for sort of rewarding the things that matter. And it's hard to have a leaderboard for kindness. That would be really cool if you could, though.
I know we're coming up on time, but I do have one final question for you. When we talked about the episode proposal, you mentioned that the idea of learning how to lose could be a topic discussed. I listened to a few interviews about winning before our show, and I was a little surprised at how much they all focused on losing. Learning how to lose, like how to cope with not being the best, that was a big question that was asked of athletic stars and celebrities and people who literally are at the top of our American scoreboard. What if someone decided that they did not ever want to learn how to lose?
That sounds to me like either they are playing in a league beneath their own ability level so that they can win all the time, or that they want to make themselves miserable. I mentioned this earlier, but I play a lot of tennis as a recreational hobby, and it occupies a lot of the spare brain space, which is not much, after work and my kids. And my favorite matches are actually the ones where I play great but lose, because it means that I am playing against someone inspirational, and I know that I have played some of the hardest points I have played in a long time, and I assume, hopefully, that that will lead to improvement. And I guess I think, to me, the most important thing about losing is making sure you learn something from it and take something away and reflect and use that to get better. And it just means that you're pushing your level and you're trying to be better. If you win all the time, it sounds like you're not really challenging yourself.
That's a great answer. Well, thank you so much for coming on my show, Melly. It was so wonderful to interview you.
Thanks, Paige. I want to ask you all the same questions you just asked me, but we'll have to save that for another 2-hour slot that we sit on a conference room floor in the sun.
With whipped cream.
And it's a commitment, and it's not always the easiest path, but I think it's the path that everyone here wants to be a part of, and that's why you joined a crazy company like this one. And when we grow, what we create are more opportunities for each other, more opportunities to lead and build and grow, and I know this team is hungry for growth, almost as hungry as you guys are for free giveaways.
There this morning, I was up, but I heard talk. Strange movements in my quiet house of a heart started betting again on my playing cards. Old habits I try to quit, they die so hard. But when I walk towards you, I believe I'm gonna win. I'm gonna win.
I don't need you all of the time, but I hope you keep me close and inside your mind. Where the storms do roll, but it's the same as mine. So sailing on the days when the wind don't blow, and I take it as a sign. At all, but I know that I love you, and it's kind of your fault. I've been gambling dice, I've been staying up all night, I've been falling asleep with all of the lights and my clothes on. Don't want to walk the dog in the morning.
Strange movements in my quiet house of a heart.